Hey, everybody. Welcome to Blades of Eversync interview with the creators. This is the first time we've had some creators from game systems that we're playing on our show, and we're super excited. The show is called Blades of Eversync, and it is set in the Sword of the Serpentine setting, which is a total mouthful, but completely worth saying because it's an awesome game. We've had a ton of fun recording this first season, and this is our opportunity to talk to the people who actually made the game, made the setting, and you know what they put into it, so you can get some background. We've got with us today Kevin Culp and Emily Dresner, who created this setting for the Gumshoe system. If you don't know what Gumshoe is, it's put out by Pelgrain Press. They've put out a lot of different things. Kevin's actually written for them before. The system is very sleek and great for investigation, and it's one of my top three, so you should definitely check it out. Swords of the Serpentine is coming out. When is the book actually going to hit?
So it should be out after the new year. It was originally going to be out in 2020, and then 2020 happened.
Right, of course. So I guess let's introduce both our creators. My question is this, you just introduce yourself, and then if I could just get a little bit of background of how you got into game design, we can start with Kevin.
Sure, I'm Kevin Culp. I'm out of Boston. My day job, I do fatigue risk management. Basically, I teach people how to sleep during the day when they're working night shifts, and I make sure they don't get involved in horrible accidents. I used to help run the D&D website, EN World, run by Russ Morrissey, and sort of slipped sideways into game design from there. Pelgrain Press was kind enough to let me co-write Alhut Trail, which is a fantasy western. From there, I went on to Time Watch, and now Swords of the Serpentine.
Awesome. Emily?
Yeah, hi. My name is Emily Dresner. As my day job, I'm an engineering director and a distributed systems expert. In my night job, I enjoy writing all kinds of crazy and sometimes very funny things in gaming. I started this by being a fan of a game called Innomine from Steve Jackson Games back in the 90s.
I remember that game.
Where I ended up working on four books. I actually do not remember, but it was a large number of books I contributed to on the nominee line. And I was a columnist for Pyramid Magazine when it was online. I wrote a big piece that Kevin Height always says is part of my great vintage, was about how to incorporate the Knights Templar into various game settings. After that, I wrote on several Vampire Masquerade lines. I worked on and I'm so sorry, this is back in the 90s, but it was the one setting that was set in the 90s, and not in the 90s, in the Chinese.
It wasn't Requiem, was it?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. And I worked on some of the medieval stuff. After that, I went to go work for Goo. I wrote a book called, oh my God, I don't remember the books I worked on. But I worked on Tenchi Muyo. I worked on Utna. I wrote the Pokemon game for Guardians of Order, which had both a PC name and a non-PC name.
Yes.
Yes, yes. Cute and Fuzzy Seizure Monsters. If I talk long enough, I will remember what I worked on. Then I took a long break to actually work in the video game industry for real. I worked on a game called The Elder Scrolls Online. And then when I was done with that, I wasn't ready to work on another game that was owned by somebody else. So I started writing a column called Dungeonomics, which was basically taking D&D and writing ridiculous economics jokes. And then that migrated from my blog, which had 30 people reading it passionately. So I felt very comfortable writing exceedingly ridiculous things. So it went to Critical Hits, which is run by Dave Chalker. And we wrote a ton. Yes, I know that I need to pull them all and format them all and release them in a compendium. I've been told a bunch of times. And then Kevin was reading those. And then I had a playtest copy of Time Watch. I contributed to one of the Time Watch books, a small story in the Time Watch books. And then Kevin said, hey, why don't you come write this thing called Eversync with me? And I was like, all right. And then we've been spending years on this book now.
Yeah, I think it's about 3 years, something like that. It's by the time it's finally out. When I started with Swords of the Serpentine wasn't the original name, but when we started, I immediately knew I wanted to work with Emily, because if you've ever read Dungeonomics, they're brilliant, and it is exactly what we needed for this setting. My rule of thumb is always work with people who are way better than you are, and this is no exception.
That is a good rule of thumb. I have done that with my cast. It's like, I am not an actor. I do everything behind the scenes. They make me look better than I am. So, speaking of which, one of the things that piqued my interest about the setting and everything was the fact that it was this like really cool mix of Conan and Terry Pratchett and just that kind of feel. I felt that, you know, that was the thing that I was gravitating to, because I think a lot of times we think about fantasy in the role-playing setting, and there, I played D&D since before Emily did Requiem, I hate to say, but it's one of those things where it's like, I'm always looking for really good places to play fantasy in, and this one struck a chord. Where did you guys come up with the idea? Was the economics kind of sparked the idea of the funny, you know, sword and sorcery kind of thing? How did it come about?
So the very first iteration of Eversink showed up in my D&D game, where it was a highly political city that was slowly sinking into the mud of the swamp that was around it. And I loved that enough that when I left it behind and moved on to other games and other campaigns, I knew I wanted to come back and visit it. So basically, I had this idea, which I plopped down in Emily's lap, and everything else is hers.
Yeah, so the setting has a zillion influences. One of the big ones, obviously, is from Kevin's D&D game about the political city with the buildings that are infinitely sinking forever. There is obviously a big chunk of the history of Venice inside of that city, but that's not the only influence by a long shot. I love Terry Pratchett. Just like everybody does, I love Ankh-Morpork. I actually love the history of future cities. I really like the thought of how cities develop over long periods of time and what that really means. So like the history of Paris or the history of St. Petersburg or the history of London. I'm really into the history of London. The history of New York and how New York has developed. And you start thinking of in boroughs and clans and different factions and how different ways that cities actually develop over time. Cities are very organic beast. Mm-hmm. And like everything, they're all about the people. So, right. So Kevin has a dictate about setting design, which is every single sentence needs to be able to be spun off into a game seed. So when we're talking about the setting and setting design for Eversink, one of the big things is that, so I used to love Elmore Leonard back in the day, and mostly because he was a writer from Detroit, and I'm originally from Detroit, and apparently I only do Detroit things, before he moved down to Florida. And Elmore Leonard wrote a great book about writing, and he had this one line that always resonated with me, which is cut the boring stuff. So when we're talking about setting and city design, I really wanted the city to be this living, breathing, very hooky thing where people could set whatever game they really wanted to set that was for a city. But it had enough resonance of a real city so that like it's easier to develop concepts around while being flexible enough that anybody could set their game in that setting. So that was really the overarching design goal. And then you start feeding in all these different influences.
Right, like, of course.
Lankmara, all this good stuff.
Yeah, it needed to echo Lankmar from Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser. It needed to echo Camor from Lies of Lankmara. Obviously, Ankh-Morpork. And, you know, I remember the moment when I first heard about how Chicago basically, like Seattle, raised all their seats because everything was sinking. And for
like
a while, you would try to walk through along the sidewalks of Chicago and have to climb ladders for the people who had already raised their entrances to the second story and then climb downstairs on the far side to keep walking on ground level. And I thought, oh, like this can be the seat of something.
Yeah, can you imagine in the 1800s being like, you know, we need a sewer system. We have all these buildings. Let's just pick them up and put it underneath them. It's just like, what the hell? Yeah, cities are, it's funny. I've been I've been kind of looking into Mesopotamian ancient history and on Babylon and everything else lately, which always springs up a bunch of ideas of like, oh, I want to do this and that. And you're very right. The organic nature of cities is very interesting. So I want to talk about the gumshoe system for just a second. What, you know, obviously, Kevin, you'd already done a book with the gumshoe system, but for both of you, what is it about the gumshoe system that works well with this setting?
So I think the most important thing here for me is that gumshoe in general, and both Swords of the Serpentine and Time Watch and a few other games in general, presume competence. It's like the TV show Leverage, which Sean Rogers describes as competence porn, where you don't, it's not like starting in first level D&D. You start off already being really good at what you do, and you're good at your job, and the game rules promote and support that, as well as giving a really nice mechanic for letting players steal a bunch of spotlight time to do very cool things. That's what really drew me to it.
So prior to Swords of the Serpentine, my favorite gumshoe game is Trails of Cthulhu. I am like a Cthulhu player, 5th edition COC, hardcore, die. We are all going to die believing that 5th edition is the best. Take that, Ken. But I love the investigation mechanics in Trial of Cthulhu. I mean, I struggled for years with regular Call of Cthulhu with, okay, roll this 100, now you suck and now you die. And it managed to solve that problem with a lot of the investigation, because Cthulhu at the end of the day is just a book collection game. It's a game about collecting books, which appeals to me on many levels. So if you think about living in a city, a Conan-like city, you really want your players to be investigating murders, investigating horrors from underneath the city, investigating the ancient history of the city, investigating people who want to do terrible things to your city. So you start to really think about, all right, gumshoe's really more of a social, cerebral, investigation-based game system about finding secrets and digging up people's dirty laundry, and then you put that in a city, and then you give everybody swords, and then you let them go to town. Yeah.
I've gotten a lot of pushback from people originally saying, why do you have a game about investigation that's playing, doing sword and sorcery? And the truth is that every fantasy game is all about investigation. When you're trying to track down the treasure, when you're trying to avoid traps and solve the lich's mad riddles, I mean, like, that is complete investigation start to finish. And it's a beautiful fit. It just isn't one, I think people assume that, you know, you're wearing fedoras and slinking along back alleyways. There's no fedoras here.
I think for me, as I said, I started with D&D eons ago. And I think that the thing that, like, with the investigation part, if you worry about that too much, you're not seeing the whole picture of, you know, you can be the city watch, you can be a heist crew, you can be working with the Triskaidane or whatever. There's a billion different ways to make it work. And, you know, if you love going out into the wilderness, you can do that. If you love doing dungeon delves, you can do that. But it actually frees you up to do a lot more role playing. We're always looking for games that are not so technically fiddly that it slows down the action, because our main goal is to entertain people with the podcast. And that's one reason we've gravitated towards gumshoe. We played a few Fear Itself games, and I have all of the Trail of Cthulhu games. And it's just really, it's really well done. So yeah, I would, if you're thinking, wait a minute, investigation fantasy, get past that and just read it. Because it's really good. So what aspect of, since we're talking about the setting, what aspect of the setting are you both most proud of?
Well, I love the city layout. I love the different boroughs of the city, and that they're very distinct. So there's poor areas and immigrant areas and very rich areas and nouveau rich areas and docks and arsenals and government. And so it's got this feeling of a real city where people really live. And that feeling of a real city where people really live make it much easier to build adventures.
Right.
So that's what I love.
Yes. The, like the Tangle and, yep, and everything else. We, yeah, I'm not going to give anything away. So we were all over that city. Let me tell you, we went to literally almost, I think, every district and had something happen. And that was a great thing, was that layout and being able to like, this is, you know, the Upper Harbor. And this is, yeah, I agree with you. That was a lot of fun. So, Kevin?
For me, I think the thing, and there's a, I love the fact that the city's basically an iceberg with, as the buildings keep sinking, that means you can just keep going down underground. But the thing I love most, I think, is this idea that people aren't burying their dead. Not really. What's important is that when someone dies, they get a funerary statue made of them. It could be tiny, you know, a small clay statue. It could be 20 feet tall and made out of bronze in the city square. But as long as that statue exists, the idea that you're guaranteed a place in heaven and your spirit is at rest, because when the statue is broken and if your soul's not annihilated, that means your ghost is running around. And one of the abilities, Spirit Sight, lets the character literally rip a hole between worlds and take the party into the realm of spirits, where you can walk through the streets of Eversink watching the ghosts of buildings rising and falling around you as you walk back in time. And that's fun. Awesome. You can use staircases that were demolished decades ago.
Right. That's awesome. And I got to say that the hardest part about the interview is the fact that we have already recorded the entire season. So it's like trying not to give away anything. Since you're talking about spirits, let's talk about Denari, right? Is that the right way to say it? Denari?
Oh, yeah.
The goddess of Eversink. Obviously, she's super important. And give me your take on her. We'd start with Emily. What's Denari like to you?
Denari is the goddess of shameless capitalism.
Yeah.
like no holds barred, straight out of Amsterdam in the 17th century. No regulations, no nothing. Total free open markets, baby. Like total unfettered capitalism. Yeah.
One of the, I can't top that, but let me try. So the game presumes small gods, that if you have a god of something annoying getting stuck in your kitchen drawer, like, and that bothers you long enough, a very tiny spirit will manifest based on your belief. And Denari 1,000 years ago was just a swan spirit who a bunch of very desperate people asked for help. And now because they believe in her, their belief shapes who she is today. Which brings up some interesting possibilities, including the fact that there could be multiple Denaris based on who you happen to worship. And that, like, you know, any good religious war, you might have different parts of the priesthood that worship very different Denaris. And that might play out in game.
Underneath Denari is a bunch of factions. These are different groups, like the commoners. The city is ruled by this mysterious organization called the Triskaidane, who are basically a council from all, you know, they pick people from all these different factions. And also, just so I don't forget, there is a wonderful website that you can go to and make your character and do all they'll tell you who's in the Triskaidane for your thing. You can do a whole bunch of different stuff. It does NPCs, the whole nine yards. And I'm forgetting, Kevin, what's the website called again?
So the website is, hang on a second, let me just pull up the URL, 2 seconds. I think it's called Swords of the Serpentine Tools, but it's at monstar.co.nz /mat/SOTS tools. You know what? Put a link.
I will put a link.
If you Google Swords of the Serpentine Hero Generator, you're going to get a link.
Okay, cool. Great. Yeah, and it helped out a great deal. But anyway, and I wanted to mention it before I forgot. But so there are all these different factions, different people from those different factions make up the Triskaidane, and you don't know who's in the Triskaidane. And sometimes monsters, which is another faction, are a part of them. So, you know, you have merchants, you have commoners, there is ancient nobility, which aren't necessarily in charge of anything. They're just the oldest families in the city. How did you develop them, and which ones spark your interest the most when you're doing games?
So when we were first thinking about how to handle the factions, Discworld is actually, an Ankh-Morpork is a really lovely description of this, where you've got the City Watch as a faction, and Lord Vedinari as a faction, and the nobles, and the trolls, and the dwarves, and what have you. And each one is sort of a separate social chunk of the city that butts heads with each other. If there's anything I'm really pleased about rules-wise to have added into Gumshoe, it's both social combat and the idea that the players can ally themselves with these organizations, these factions, and manipulate them to get what they want, in addition to using them to get information. In an early playtest game, I knew I got this right because the heroes had to break into an assassin's guild to steal something, and it was being guarded by mercenaries, and one of the heroes was allied with the mercenaries, and the guy says, wait, can I spend these points to have these people be in my same company? I said, sure. He goes, can I spend all my points and I'm their commander? I'm like, sure. And he simply ordered the mercenaries guarding the Assassin's Guild back to camp, giving them a free rein in.
That's awesome. Emily, what are your thoughts on the faction?
I have lots of opinions on the faction. On the Triskaidane, I sometimes amuse myself imagining Eversink is ruled entirely by the power of a random number generator. And that Denari just picks 13 random people off the street and totally pretends like this is something that's official and just to see what happens.
You get 13 years.
Yeah. It's kind of like picking 13 anonymous people off of Reddit and telling them to go around a city. So, and nothing bad could happen from that. So what really caught my eye is the ancient nobility, just the image of these people who were sitting around their dining room table in total darkness in their slowly sinking tower, wearing their moldering silks, eating off of gold plates and eating porridge because they were too proud to actually sell those plates for money, for food. And for some reason, that just, for me, the ancient nobility crystallized everything. Now, I love the Mercanti. Those are my bros. If you ever read any of my Mercanti stuff, you'll see that I have nothing but, I'm not going to have any favorites, but I have a favorite. Because they work with the Denari ethos of let's basically go destroy the world for cash. So they're like natural evil, and I love the natural evil. You can make Mercanti be as terrible as you possibly want, and their motivation is really easy, right? They just want to rule the world. And
is that so wrong?
And is that so wrong? Will you hold that against them?
If there's one thing, you mentioned the Triskaidane before, Wes, and in one of our playtest games, the heroes accidentally killed one of the secret rulers of the city, one of the members of the Triskaidane. They found that out the hard way when they looted his body and found his gold coin that signifies that he's a secret ruler. And the next day, a bunch of official people showed up on their doorstep and hired them to solve the murder because they used prophecy to find out who had killed them. And the prophecy told the investigators that these heroes were the most likely people to learn who killed them. Of course, that's because they killed him himself, but
that's really cool. That kind of dovetails into, or swan tails, let's just keep it there, into my next question, which is how wealth works and why it's important to kind of the coolness and the sword and the sword and sorcery aspect of things. How did wealth work into the game?
My favorite ability in Gumshoe is an ability called preparedness. And preparedness says, hey, we don't worry about gearing up. You just make a roll if you want something funky. And if you succeed at your roll, you totally remember to bring it with you. So my big challenge when designing the rules was, how the heck do you match that up with a money system? Because, you know, fantasy, all about the loot store. And we had to make that work. We went through a lot of different iterations on this. And what we finally settled on is that while we have an incredibly complex and delightful system of coinage that nobody should ever remember because it's impossible to remember, you get your treasure in terms of wealth, where wealth, if you spend, and then you spend that wealth to live a certain lifestyle for the adventure. Wealth one means you're living in the gutter and and grabbing food away from rats. Wealth 5 means you're living richer than the goddess in an opulent lifestyle. And you'll gain wealth as you adventure, and then you will spend it at the beginning of each adventure to figure out what your lifestyle is. And based on what you choose, you get societal bonuses. It'll either give you an advantage or a disadvantage, depending on what kind of a person you're talking to. So if you are living a poor lifestyle but have to deal with commoners, you can be doing a lot better than that guy who's dripping with gems and furs this adventure. The goal is make people run through their cash as much as possible.
I think the thing that I think of a lot is in Conan when he's like on the horse, just covered in the movie where he's covered in gold coming through the city, and then he punches a camel for some reason. But it's that sort of thing. What were some other things about the setting in particular that you guys wanted to make sure were part of the setting, flavor-wise? Like, I know that it's kind of got a Renaissance feel to it. I heard something about pointy shoes.
Fashion's important. There's somebody in the city who pays profits to tell them what the fashions are going to be next week so they can be the first person wearing them. But Emily, here, let me start for you. Food, take it.
Oh, yeah. So I'm a big nerd of the history of food. I'm a big nerd on a lot of different dimensions, but that's one of them. And slightly obsessed with how people ate in the city. So if you read the setting, you'll see that there's a lot of restaurants that are around. But it's really important. If you think about like a gaming adventuring group, what happens? Well, everybody ends up in the tavern. Everybody ends up sitting around a table. Everybody ends up having a meal. Everybody ends up drinking some booze, either to plot where they're going to go or talk about where they've just been. So wouldn't it be nice if we talked about what was actually on the table? So I get really weird about, oh, well, you know, they've got pigs, but not, because you have to have pigs in the city because they're living garbage cans, but you can't have cows. There's no room. You can't really have horses. Everything's canals. You've got chickens everywhere. That makes sense. And eels. You've got to have eels. They're running out of eels. A lot of eels. So everything's eel pie. I incorporated some of the things like Venice has a big history of originally being founded on salt ponds. And salt is a major driver of wealth in the medieval era. Because without it, you die. And whoever owns it, right, gets to dictate basically how much it costs. So I always had the original Eversink wealth being based on the salt marshes outside the city. But now you got salt marshes outside the city. So now you clearly have some sort of salt creature living in the salt marshes outside the city. So now you've got an adventure.
What I did with the campaign is each person started off in a different location. And yeah, at some point they end up at a pub. I think they were at the Red Pig because I used the generator and came up with that. You were going to say something, Kevin?
Yeah. And by the way, let me just mention that all of the generators on that tools page were created by Matthew Breen, who is my secret shady co-designer and a bunch of things that I create. And he has been unbelievably helpful in both sort of thinking out this game and Time Watch before it, and in creating all of those electronic tools. So kudos to Matt.
Yeah, they're a great help. He did a great job on those.
For me, I'm tempted to say disease is one of my favorite setting issues because I had a lot of fun designing the diseases. But I think for me, the actual thing, the name Serpentine refers to the Serpentine River, which Eversink sits at the bottom of. But it also refers to the hideous snake people who ruled this area more than 1,000 years ago and who are definitely dead and who are long since died out and aren't living deep, deep beneath the city at all. That is a silly rumor that has no basis in fact.
Right. Of course.
Yes.
Of course. Just real quick, what changed the most during playtesting? Was there one thing that came out during playtesting that you're like, okay, we're going to redo this, or an idea that really sparked something that gave you some, you know, epiphany?
Yeah, two things. Mechanically, so there's a cool thing I think it's a cool thing that we're doing with Gumshoe Mechanics called maneuvers, which basically say, hey, if you want to disarm this person, if you want to convince that person to let you into the building, and want to do it through social combat or, you know, through the flick of a wrist, whatever, we have a mechanical way to make that happen. And that, when it first came out in playtest, was unbelievably broken. Like, just plain didn't work. And I had deluded myself for a year that it did. So thanks to playtest, that went from a nice idea that was horribly implemented to actually it works really well. The other thing which I really am delighted by that changed during playtesting was sorcery.
Yeah, sorcery.
I knew that we wanted social combat as well as physical combat, but we weren't sure when we started how to handle the sorcery. And what I ended up doing was actually taking a page from Robin D. Laws's long ago feng shui game in terms of how sorcerers could basically make their sorcery look like whatever they wanted to. It doesn't matter. The mechanics of the game were what drove the sorcery's effect. And right. We implemented that here as well so that you have total free reign as to what you want your sorcery to look like within certain spheres like plants or lightning or, you know, whatever. But the actual implementation and how you implement that is really up to player creativity. And I love how that sort of evolved and changed.
I want to say one thing about sorcery is that we were at Metatopia in some year in the before times. And Kevin's like, hey, you want to play this game? And I'm like, okay. And one of the players was a prototype sorcerer, is a flesh sorcerer that can like just pull out globs of flesh and mold them, like turn them into like little dudes that ran around. And it was truly horrible. And he had the servant. So he was a servile sorcerer that was a flesh sorcerer. So he was like that horrible serpent, horrible servant all dressed in black who you knew was just like trying to rip your heart out. And I was like, yeah, I think this is a good game. I think we should do this. Yeah. So that was like, this is awful. This is absolutely delightful. I'm going to second the 2000 revisions of the sorcery rules that they went through. The sorcery rules went through a lot of work. The bane of my existence was the trap rules. I did not enjoy them for a while there.
Did you like how they ended up?
They came out much better at the end.
I was right near the end and was reading the trap rules and said, oh my God, these are so boring. I hate them. And I said, then why am I putting them in my game? And I ripped them out and rewrote all of them, and I'm much happier with the result. Unfortunately, redoing the trap rules made me redo maneuvers, which also made me redo sorcery. So there was this horrible, like, 9-day cascade of rules changes, but it was for the better.
Well, when you throw a stone in a pond, yeah. You know.
Oh, yeah. Domino effect.
It's going to go everywhere. So we've mainly talked about Eversync. That's the focus of where Blades of Eversync obviously is going to be this season. But there are lands outside yep. of Eversync. And I just kind of, what are the lands outside of Eversync like?
I was taking my hand and trying to be openly multicultural to, so like the people that live at Eversync, they're like sort of brownish people. They're by nature. But I was trying to open it up so that you could have any plausible nationality that you really wanted walking through Eversync. You could be anybody you wanted. You didn't have to be like our generic sort of Mediterranean person. I mean, they're all humans until Kevin does something magical. But for now, I wanted people that like could come from the Middle East. I really like the Mongols that I put in, right? The horse lords. I thought that having horse lords, it was important for me that I had a pirate nation that was run by a woman who was a badass. That was important to me. So that's me. Yeah, totally. I wanted to put in like creepy sorcerer towers and I wanted to make it clear that there's no sorcery in Eversync, but that doesn't mean there's no sorcery outside of Eversync, right? That's a Denari thing, but that's not generally a every place else in the world. Every place else in the world, sorcery is just as horrible, but it doesn't mean that it's not horrible and totally accepted.
How does corruption work outside of Eversync? Does it hurt any of the other gods? Because it hurts Denari.
Sure. And the short answer to that is, oh, hell if I know. I mean, so there's that's a mechanical answer, right? When you draw on corruption to cast sorcerer spells, you do one of two things. You internalize it, in which case it changes something physical about you. And I did that because I wanted, Ningobble of the Seven Eyes from Fafnir and the Grey Mouser is, you know, cloaked with a lot of little eyeballs moving around in there inside the cloak. And I'm like, oh, I want a reason that a player can evolve that naturally. But also, if you externalize it, it messes with the morale of all of your friends. So all of the bonus stuff, the fact that chickens lay rocks instead of eggs and babies start crying and, you know, don't stop for 6 months, all, you know, that's all window dressing. Outside of it, I don't think it necessarily interferes with other gods. I think it'd be really fun to have it be different in different realms, just right, based on what the GM thinks is cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, and again, that's part of the thing that draws me to Gumshoe is the fact that you do give players and GMs a lot of room to kind of build it the way that they want to play it, which is great. So there are four different character professions, and I'm going to try to rattle them off. I believe it's thief, warrior, sentinel, and what's the fourth
sorcerer.
One? Sorcerer. So, but within that, there's a ton of customization that you can do. You can do a sneak thief. You can do just a lot of stuff. What are your guys' favorite character builds? Do you have one?
Not yet, actually. I don't have a favorite character build yet.
That's a really interesting question. I think my favorite character build leans more towards the like Kugel the Clever or Kugel the Clever from Dying Earth, Jack Vance's mm-hmm. novels, who doesn't necessarily have to even own a weapon and is still incredibly efficient in combat and in confrontation. I really enjoy sorcerers because I like the creativity they can do with the magic system. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's probably not really going to be good for you if you do that.
Right.
But I love the fact that one of the abilities is ridiculous luck. So if you're playing a thief with ridiculous luck, you know, you can really lean on that. We had one player who didn't have a lot of other abilities, but had five ranks of ridiculous luck, which meant that he was just, they called him like Lucky, whatever his name was. And in combat, he never actually was seen wielding a sword. Just bad things happened to the people he was fighting. And it was really fun to see.
That's awesome because luck is a fantastic superpower.
Yeah,
it really is. It is. We have in the game, two of the players are, I will be able to say this, two of our players are playing brother and sister. And one of them, the brother, has five ranks of ridiculous luck, and she hates him. He's always getting his way. He's always doing everything right.
Yep. There are rules, at least for if that happens, that you can hit somebody, just hammer someone with that many ranks with really bad luck for a scene.
Right. Yeah. Which I think we did a couple of times it came up, but it's a lot of fun because of the dynamic between the brother and sister.
That's great.
My last question is, will you guys be expanding on the setting with further books? He asks, hoping.
So one of the reasons that the external locations outside of Eversink are painted with a pretty broad stroke is so that either GMs or we can dive into those and do something pretty specific and pretty remarkable with them. So we give you sort of the basic feel for it, for you to fake it in the meantime, and then you can develop those yourself if that's a thing you love to do.
Right.
I am working right now. So we have a adventure series that will be coming out called The Slithering God, which will still set primarily in Eversink. I'm currently working on a book of non-human heroes so that you can play something like 25 other ancestries mm-hmm. and still have it. Some of those are really sort of high fantasy and they don't fit into the gritty sword and sorcery world at all. Some of them fit into sword and sorcery and Eversink really beautifully. And I'm breaking it up between those two. I think that what we do with external development outside of the city depends on how much people love the game, right?
Yeah,
if that's right. Something people want to see, then that's something we'll do.
What, Emily, what part of the world would you like to expand on?
Oh, man. if I'm leaving Eversync and I could go expand on anything. Oh, I have notes on like the northern Nordic city that's all sort of, it edges a little bit too close to steampunk for the Eversync setting, but I think I've worked out how to make it work. So I have notes on that place. They've got giant dirigibles, and I love the idea of them having sorcery empowered dirigibles that they can go drop bombs on the horse lords with.
That's funny.
So I love the pirates. The pirates have been, they're very close to my heart. I just love the idea of these giant floating barnacle colored cities full of witch queens, with all the boats that are capsized and all lashed together and all one giant city. And it never actually has like a home place. It just floats back and forth through the ocean. So those are my favorites.
These are leading questions because, first season is definitely set in Eversync, but second season I am planning on branching out a little bit and going into the outer realms as they were. So it's good to hear what you guys like about the different parts of it. Go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, I was just going to say I have it'll appear in Pelgrane's C-Page XX blog on their website in December, but I've written up a city called Joining, which is not really set in the same world necessarily, but it is a small town in the middle of a giant sequoia forest, basically, that a couple hundred years ago was an interplanar nexus to multiple places, both in this world and in other worlds as well. And through adventuring, it's pretty likely that the heroes are going to end up restoring that nexus and giving themselves access to a ton of different places. And so, you know, I've laid that out as sort of a different kind of setting. If you don't want to start in a giant city, if you want to start in a small town,
right?
I'm using that as a setting for one of my playtest groups.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Good to hear. Like I said, I am a huge fan of the setting, and I'm, you know, super excited for the show to come out. And I really appreciate that you guys were able to take some time and talk to me about everything involved with it. It was great. That basically covers all of my questions. Is there anything you guys want to plug that you're working on right now that you even can plug?
Oh man, I am. And unfortunately, 2020 has really destroyed my ability to write. Unfortunately, I have a lot of things I would like to be working on. I have a whole list of them, but it's just unfortunately
the end times need to end.
Yeah, the end times need to end one way or another to restore creativity. I was starting to work on some cyberpunk ideas, but those all got shelved back in March, unfortunately.
I'm lucky that, I mean, there's a lot that I hate about the pandemic, but actually it's been really good for my creativity and productivity, maybe because I'm stuck at home. I am, in addition to all sorts of sort of fun serpentine stuff coming out, I will be probably in the start of the new year, be kickstarting a game called Loot the Kingdom. Where you are a adventurer who, unlike those goody two shoes adventurers who adventure to save the world, you're just trying to steal stuff. And over the course of the game, you accidentally steal things from the horrible bad guy, and then end up having to topple them by a series of fantasy heists because there's no other way to do it. It's probably a 3 to 9 session game. In 3 acts, but designed to feel a little bit like you are competent heroes who are really good at stealing stuff with very rules light. So anyways, that's on my plate right now.
That's great. Well, again, thank you guys so much for, you know, taking the time. I really appreciate that you guys talked with me about it. It's such a good system and it's such a good setting. And I can't wait to share Blades of Eversync with everybody so that they can then go out and get the setting for themselves and play it with their friends.
From our perspective and on behalf of Pelgrane as well, thank you so much for doing this, right? I mean, you and your players took a leap of faith and you're making our game shine. And I got to tell you, from my perspective, there is nothing more fun for me.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, I think that we all benefit from great content. So thank you guys so much. And so just so everybody can find you, we'll start with Emily. Where can people find you out there on the old internet?
You can find me on Twitter at Multiplexer, MultiPlexer.
And Kevin?
I'm also on Twitter at Kevin Culp, KevinKulp. You'll also find me, there's a Gumshoe forum on Facebook, and I'm fairly active there as well.
What about Pelgrane Press? Is it just pelgranepress.com, I believe?
It's pelgranepress.com. There's a resources page for every single one of their games, and I have one or two articles coming out a month with free adventures and sample heroes. I just did a analysis of how to play Elric of Meldabenay in Swords of the Serpentine, and a bunch of different things that you'll find there on their blog.
Blades of Eversink starts on January 8th. You can find it on all major podcast platforms. You can also find it on our website at 12sidedstories.com. I can't wait to see more from both of you. You're both great, and I'm really excited. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.